Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Sock Dem Asia podcast. I am Cassie, and I am your host. We have a very special episode today for the Sock Dem Asia podcast, and it's all about the recent conviction of former Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak. To help us cover this topic, we have a very special guest, one of the close friends of Sock Dem Asia, and his name is Howard Lee. He is a politician from Malaysia. He has a background as a student leader and an activist. He was the deputy youth chief and then youth chief of the Democratic Action Party Socialist Youth. He is a member of the Perak State Legislative Assembly for Pasir Pinji. And this is all under the Democratic Action Party of the Pakatan Harapan. And he was also the 24th president of the International Union of Socialist Youth, the first Southeast Asian elected to the post. So I'm actually not alone along with our guest. I'm also here with my co-host. Say hi, Carlo.
Hi. Okay. That's all right.
Hi, Carlo.
Hi, Howard.
Yeah. So Howard, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on this podcast. So, the conviction of Najib Razak has made news all over the world, but I think it's very safe to say that a great deal of our listeners don't really know the details of this historic conviction, this historic upholding of a conviction. So I can get into it, but we also brought you on for that reason. So I think I would like to start first with talking about the body or the organization that is at the center of all of this, along with Najib Razak, which is 1MDB, which is One Malaysia Development Berhad. So it was a corruption scandal. Can you tell us a little bit about 1MDB and what it's supposed to be for the people of Malaysia?
Absolutely. Thank you for the invitation. Always an honor to speak to the audience of Sock Dem Asia, having been in the international affairs circuit for Sock Dem Asia and Social Democratic Family within Asia. Thank you, Cassie. A longtime friend of mine, Carlo, is also with us. Thank you for the invitation. And of course, when one talks about Malaysia, one must be aware of what has happened over the last 3 or 4 years. 2018 came a pivotal election where a new government was installed after 60 years of being a single party state. And then in 2018, there was a massive disruption that took place whereby my party, as part of a coalition, Pakatan Harapan, as Cassie, you pointed out correctly just now, dislodged that uninterrupted 60-year rule of Barisan Nasional that UMNO is part of. UMNO is the party that Najib was the leader of. Now, what helped or assisted and facilitated that dislodgement? Well, it's exactly what you said, the 1MDB scandal. 1MDB, I'm also aware of the fact that the audience for the show is by and large people who are completely and totally new to foreign affairs, number two, to foreign politics, or international affairs, or even Malaysian politics. But just to put it in very, very extremely simple terms, something that is very complex put into very, very little words, 1MDB is a state sovereign fund. A state sovereign fund is essentially a company or a vehicle that is put together to put the public taxpayers' money into an account that can be invested so that it returns added value. So let's say, for example, you know, in the Philippines or Indonesia, the people of the Philippines and the Indonesian people put money, some of your tax, which then get channeled into a government-linked company or a state-owned company. And this company will then go forth and invest in different ventures, whether it's property development, whether it's financial instrument investments, and to hope that 100 pesos or 100 baht or 1 million baht or 100 dollars gets invested in something that will then seek returns in added value by profiteering from that capital. 1NDB is one of such vehicles. Now, what happened was Najib Razak was the prime minister. He essentially named himself by creating 1MDB, the kind of not only the president, but he held many, many roles in which the prime minister and the finance minister at the time, and a key point to take away here, that under Najib's administration, he was both the prime minister and the minister of finance. Now, that is something that we've actually departed from, but it was actually a bit of the norm. But by virtue of the fact that he's the prime minister and the finance minister, the sovereign fund, 1MDB, made him a character that would both make the executive decision to make that investment, and as the finance minister, also sign off on the basically the money going out. So there's no check and balance. Normally, the board of the chairman of the board of directors will be a check and balance on the CEO or vice versa. And that is the power dynamics that becomes a check and balance. But because there is no difference in both the person who holds the position of prime minister and the minister of finance, there is no check and balance. But essentially what happened, and I'm coming to the landing part of it now, what he did, instead of doing what it's supposed to be, a state sovereign fund investing the money of hard-earned taxpayer ringgit, taxpayer dollars of the Malaysian people in adding value to it, he took it on a merry-go-round. He took it around the world, put it into many, many, you know, ventures that included buying necklaces for very, you know, high-profile actresses through a proxy of his or through a business partner of his, who was basically a friend of the makers of the Wolf of Wall Street. And in fact, money was even invested into the Wolf of Wall Street, the film that Leonardo DiCaprio was a producer for and an actor in. And the money just basically was stolen. And the Malaysian taxpayers' money was stolen, put into ventures that was not that isn't productive for the Malaysian people, but ended up being in private accounts of both him and his party. And he benefited a large number in terms of cash and in terms of many other benefits, but essentially that earned him, Najib Razak, the number one kleptocrat of modern day politics. So he was basically the epitome of what kleptocracy mean in modern politics. And I think I'll just stop there for the first question.
Yeah, absolutely. So in our episode notes, we actually have it down that the U.S. Department of Justice called this 1MDB scandal as the largest kleptocracy to date, which is very surprising for me personally as a Filipino with my own national experience of kleptocracy. It's a very surprising thing to hear. And I want to thank you for pointing out all of those ridiculous ways that the money was spent. So yeah, very true. The Wolf of Wall Street, it went into super yachts. In our research for this episode, what the works of the cartoonist Zunar was actually featured, and it showed Rosma Razak, who we'll be talking about a little bit later in the episode. She is the wife of Najib Razak, where it described Marie Antoinette, who loved diamonds, and Imelda Marcos, who loved shoes, and we have Grace Mugabe, who loved bags, and then we have Rosma Razak, who loves all three. So just to put in perspective the sheer magnitude of the amount of money that was stolen from the Malaysian people. So I actually want to talk about that a little bit now, because part of the reportage of the 1MDB scandal is that the currency of Malaysia experienced a crisis in relation to the scandal. So can you talk a little bit about what this scandal, how it affected the people of Malaysia and how they felt about it? Because this scandal brought people out onto the streets. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I think I will start with the policy implications of the money stolen and the lost opportunity of, let's say, if these monies were not lost, what it is needed and what it can be done for right now. Because of that, I need to draw your attention to Of course, the basically right now, we know that Najib Razak has just been convicted on a 42 million ringgit. And I would ask for your forgiveness because I'm probably not able to convert it into USD or euros or pesos.
Oh, did you say 42 currency. Million? Did you say 42 million ringgit? I have it. That's 10.6. 10.6 US, 10.6 million US dollars. So got you.
So the case of which Najib Razak was convicted and he's now in prison for implicates around about 42 million ringgit. 42 million ringgit, about 10 million USD. Okay. That is money stolen under SRC, which is basically like a satellite operation, satellite company under the 1MDB umbrella. The next case, which has not, he has not been convicted yet, but you know, he's going probably most likely to be convicted again under SRC, but another charge, previously under criminal breach of trust. This one is probably under some other very, very severe criminal charge under the criminal penal code, the Malaysian penal code. 42, previously it was 42, this is 27 million ringgit, but this does not include another several charges, one of which is round about 2.3 billion Malaysian ringgit, and another charge, which is also right now being heard and being, well, basically it's in the courts right now, another 6.64 billion ringgit. And just to kind of draw the whole thing to a close, all this was, you know, confronted with a massive cover-up by virtue of the fact that he was both the prime minister and he was the finance minister. He instructed, you know, even audit companies, he instructed government institutions to amend audit reports to hide and prevent people from seeing the fact that there have been wrongdoings. Now, 6.64 billion, 2.3 billion, 27 million, 42 million. All these monies were taken away from the country where public infrastructure were left a lot to be kind of desired for. The people needed subsidies. The people needed welfare direct transfers. And the fact is, there was something called the GST or the VAT, Goods and Services Tax or Value Added Tax in other economy. Now, he was going around as the Prime Minister to say that the government needs a lot more cash and a lot more revenue to be able to foot the bill to help the poor, to help those who need subsidies, to help people in need of direct cash transfers. And because of that, he implemented, I would say, a consumption tax called the GST and the VAT. But the fact is, that is only about 6 to 7 billion ringgit per year. Now, the fact is, let's say if what he has been, what he's about to be convicted on, actually 6.64 billion in one of the cases is being heard in court right now, plus the 42 million, plus the 27 million, plus the 2.2 billion. If all these did not go missing, if all these were not stolen by him, well, at least another 2 or 3 years worth of GST would not have been needed to be collected. And he would not have needed to remove 4 to 6 billion ringgit from the market by extracting cash and tax from the public. Mm-hmm. So there is a very direct relationship with the need to essentially take more tax, collect and extract more taxation from the people with the money he stole. So that is one very simple, and that will have direct correlation with policy making, capacity to really help the poor, targeted subsidies or untargeted subsidies or otherwise. All these are part and parcel of why he needed to be removed, and he did get removed because he was stealing money from the people that would have otherwise been spent on the public and the Malaysian people.
Howard, I'd like to ask, you know, since you mentioned that this is a really huge scandal that happened, and it's really satisfying to hear that there is some sort of, well, there is conviction, and there he's facing, still facing some other legal cases. So I'd like to ask now, what, as a Malaysian, how does this legal victory in convicting Najib feel, or how is it taken? How do the ordinary Malaysians see that victory? Do they see it? How do they appreciate that legal victory? Because as far as I know, even before the conviction or before the final decision of the court, a lot of Malaysians were saying that, you know, the kind of legal system that was set in place doesn't always favor, or rather it's tilted in favor of the powerful. So how do you see it in terms of this decision forwarding, you know, the cause of accountability, good governance, etc.?
Well, it's actually quite funny and apt that Carlo, you mentioned about how you know, the tilt of power would probably be used if they still had it. If he or Najib still had power, would probably use the power to tilt it so that you know, his wrongdoings would be covered. But because of this, because of what he did, it inspired and informed and motivated the Malaysian public to vote against his party, UMNO and Barisan Nasional. And for the first time in Malaysian history, well, his party and he was voted out of power. And my coalition, the coalition that my party was a part of, actually won the federal elections and several state level general elections, and we formed government. And because of that, we were able to, you know, put things back in the right place, and put powers and essentially prosecutive powers back in doing the right thing, which is to not selectively prosecute people who are not with power, and selectively not prosecute those who are in power. So because of what he did, he was voted out of office, and his party was voted out of office. And because he was voted out of office, we were able to put things back on track so that he can be charged in court. And he was charged in court. And, you know, ultimately what happened a few days back or a couple of weeks back was that, you know, he kind of got into prison because the people, you know, realized what he did, and he is now in prison. But that would not have happened if it didn't bring an uprising of people to vote against his party. Now, of course, it must come with a caveat, which is the fact that despite the fact that he was removed from power, his party is still heavily influential, who went forth and did a power grab and a coup d'etat, a political coup d'etat, which brought them back into government, you know, before the term ended. So midway through the term that we were supposed to serve, his party went forth and I would say bought as in the past tense of buying, bought over a lot of MPs, caused a lot of people to kind of jump over and cross the aisle and no longer support our government because we were a ministerial system, and we lost power. They regained power, but the judicial system was irreversibly changed, that, well, we were able to make sure, the people was able to make sure that he goes into prison.
Ayan, Howard, I want to ask you a question in relation to that. So the sand is still very much shifting in Malaysia. So
yes,
in the research that we did for this episode, Najib Razak is still very largely popular. And some news reports have, or some opinions shared on some news networks have shared that this is very much not the end of his political career. Like, he could still very much make a comeback. Can you let us know a little bit about what it will look like for transitional justice, or at least making sure that accountability gets served for this? Because convicting him and putting him into prison is just one step. There's still so much that needs to be done. We haven't even begun talking about recovery of the stolen wealth. So can you tell us a little bit about the shifting sands? Thank you.
In terms of the shifting sands, you are right in saying that he is still fairly popular. I wouldn't say go. I wouldn't go as far as saying he's largely popular.
That's great.
He's definitely he's largely popular on social media. But you and I know that being largely popular in social media can be ascertained, can be acquired through monetary means. Mm-hmm. And he has a lot of that because of what he did and what he stole in the past. So, mm-hmm. We don't take that away from him, the fact that he probably has invested a lot of money in bolstering his public profiles, especially through social media. But I think what has also happened is the fact that with social media, I'm sure similar trends are being observed in the Philippines as well, and also similar trends are being observed throughout the Asia-Pacific region, which is that, people with money are able to gain and buy eyeballs through social media with money. Mm-hmm. So that popularity may not necessarily translate to acceptability. That may not necessarily translate to numbers in terms of votes and turnout on polling day. Now, that context needs to be placed very, very clearly and starkly against what I'm about to say. Now, despite the fact that I question whether or not he is, his popularity will translate into votes, Malaysia is still largely and overtly a very conservative society. And Najib is able to straddle on that space, that social political positioning space, that is both able to pander to the conservative, religious, or highly influenced by religiosity crowd, but at the same time being, that efficient, neoliberal, libertarianistic, economic, high-flying, modern guy that he would like to paint himself as, right? So because number two, there are two things. Number one, because of his party and the I would say hard to disturb and disrupt base that they have, having been in power for 60 years. And it's also to do with the fact that, he's been in government for 60 years, and people see power with influence, along with influence, and influence with power. So especially with the influence that he is able to buy from social media, he's able to project that notion that because he's got influence and he's got power, he's the one to be trusted. But of course, that changed in 2018 when we came into power. But he's also using that base that he has on social media, that influence that he has, to discredit us who became government because the people supported us, but because of the power grab he's now and his power, his party is now back in power, to chip off on the credibility that we have managed to gain. So I would say in summary, what I would say is the power and the money and the influence that he has because of the platform and the party that he's part of that has been in power for 60 years, he's able to preserve a certain degree of credibility despite the fact that he's been proven to be a criminal. And actually, unfortunately, criminals may not necessarily be seen in the negative light, because when you have a social media presence that's as large as his, you can get other things to cover that criminality. So I would say the people, by and large, despite and albeit much more educated as they may have been pre-social media, but people can still be swept off their feet by something that looks credible. And I think the challenge for us, the progressives, the social democrats, and the movement that brought about change in 2018 got taken away, we need to prove that actually he's a criminal. His party is full of people like him who was not only complicit of what he did, but played a part in continuing that power structure. And we need to remove that. And we need to remove that with the people's support.
Absolutely. That is a really great segue into the next question I would want to ask, which is that you're absolutely right. So Najib Razak certainly did not act alone. and he has many accomplices, but just for the purposes of this podcast, we're going to focus on his accomplices inside of UMNO. Can you talk a little bit about the state of UMNO now, at least in terms of law enforcement with regard to his accomplices and other people who are responsible? Because this will not begin and end with Najib Razak, as in everybody else who was responsible will need to be brought to accountability as well for the benefit of the Malaysian people. So can you talk to us a little bit about the accomplices and, you know, the cleaning up that needs to be done?
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to say something that is, you know, very controversial for social democrats and socialists in general. I would never paint an entire party in the light and color of an individual, right? I wouldn't do that, and I refuse to do that. UMNO, whether you like it, whether you agree with their ideology or their founding principles or their principles, if they have any, whether you agree with it or not, they are still a force to be reckoned with, and they are still highly, highly, I would say, treasured and valued as political representation, whether it be at the state and provincial level or at the federal level. They are still going to hold, I would say, no less than, I would say, 20% of the seats in parliament, right? That's a fact that we can't run away with. Which means that a party of that kind of stature and that kind of influence needs to have some degree of cleansing, some degree of cleanup, some degree of, I would say, renewal, rejuvenation, whatever the term that you may want to use. Now, with Najib going into prison, that is a clear message that law and order still has a place, and definitely once again has a place in Malaysia. Now, that if one was to juxtapose that with the several UMNO leaders who are currently still elected in public office, but are facing very high profile cases, being, I would say, essentially the court and the justice system is hearing their case to see whether or not they're going to be convicted as criminals for the complicity of what they did when they were in government with Najib at its head. I think that's very encouraging, because there are quite a few of them, including his wife, Najib's wife, including some former ministers, including some former heads of agencies and government-linked companies, right? So in terms of the need for cleansing and the need, I'm not saying cleansing as in ethnic cleansing.
Oh, yes, yes.
Cleansing as in the cleanup of UMNO, there is definitely something I agree absolutely is in the need, because they're still going to be highly influential. But on the other end of the spectrum, will UMNO and is UMNO accepting of this reality of this clean up operation that needs to happen? I only need to draw on one example, which is who is currently the president of UMNO, the president of the party that Najib is a member of. The president, his name is Zaid Hamidi. He is an MP from my great beloved state, the state of Perak. He is also facing the court's judgment on, I would say, up to 60, if not probably more, 60 or 70 counts of wrongdoings, or financial wrongdoings, for when he was minister in the past. Now, by virtue of that, I can tell you that UMNO is split into several different camps. There's one camp that is in positions of power in the party, but because of the cases that they have held against them in the public courts, they're not able to be ministers, or was not chosen to be ministers. So you have one group who are in power in the party, who still hold the reins of power in the party, but not holding the reins of power in government. And there's, of course, the other group who holds the reins of power in government, but do not hold reins of power in the party. So there's two split there. The Prime Minister of Malaysia right now is but a mere vice president of UMNO. And he is at loggerheads to high heavens in public and in private with the leadership of the party right now, because the leadership is pushing him to dissolve parliament so that they can go into absolute power again, so that they can influence the courts, right? And of course, with these two camps at loggerhead, I haven't mentioned that there is another camp, which is, I would say the intellectuals and the progressives within the party, who's basically sitting there waiting for these two camps to fight themselves out and to perhaps even take power when they both of these camps kind of fall on their knees and, you know, fall on their faces, or perhaps to find who wins and then to side with the side who wins. Now, UMNO is in absolute tatters. They are in a mess. They are upside down. They're fighting against each other in public and in within party circles. And what they can only say right now is to push for general elections to, I would say, clean the slate so that they can go back to inverted commas, quote unquote, political stability, which actually means, in their language, absolute power, so that they can take back all the instruments of state, all the instruments of justice, so that they can get Najib out of prison, to get the president out of, you know, this current mess in the courts. That's what they think will happen. And which is why I think the people of Malaysia need to make a very clear choice, a continuation agenda, to make sure that UMNO is not in power in the next election, to avoid and averse all this happening. So I don't know if I answer your question, but I think that context would definitely provide some kind of enlightenment for people to make their own judgment of what kind of a party UMNO is and where they are right now.
Okay. So Howard, since you already mentioned the elections, it's a good segue. So to the last question, what do you think this conviction and the current fortune of Najib and UMNO will lead into the next general election, given that, you know, most analysts are saying that it's likely to happen within the next few months? So do you think this latest development will be positive for the Pakatan Harapan, the opposition coalition, or do you think there's still some possibility that the UMNO and the and their allies will likely use or re-strategize and win, or at least make some inroads in the next general election? What's your forecast?
Now, I think I will answer that question on two separate dimensions. Number one, assuming the elections are going to be as I forecasted the first week of November, which is, you know, what's going to happen, likely is going to happen, is that Ismail Sabri, who's the prime minister right now, is going to, I would say, buckle at the pressure given to him by his party. He's going to table the budget for 2023 on the 7th of October, and immediately after, or a day later, he's going to ask the king to dissolve parliament, which will make way for elections on likely the first or second week of November. So 7th of October, budget, 8th of October, or of a day after that, dissolve, and then elections on the first week of November. So assuming that happens, and of course, I personally still think it could be still held in quarter one next year, but let's put that aside. Assuming it's going to happen in November, we need to be absolutely cognizant, the Malaysian people need to be cognizant, aware, and accepting of a completely new political landscape. A new political landscape whereby it's no longer a two-party system. Malaysia is no longer about the opposition versus those in government. What transpired over the last 2 or 3 years is that when UMNO decided to coalesce with a party who was previously a party part of Pakatan Harapan, and this party called Bersatu, when they defected from our coalition to go and work with UMNO to form a different government that happened in 2020, that made UMNO no longer the absolute power, despite the fact that they have the prime ministership. And what happened is these two coalitions, what transpired was they formed a new coalition, and then it's now a situation whereby there's been another two prime minister changes. There's now three coalitions that have all been in federal power, that have all been, many of it, that has been in power in many states. So it's now at least a three-party system whereby you've got three governments in waiting, three coalitions who's able to gain, I would say, significant number of votes amongst the public, and three coalitions waiting to be government. And every single bit of polling that we've done, every set of statistics that we have managed to get from any kind of respectable pollster tells us that none of any of these three coalitions are going to be able to get outright majority in parliament. So the people need to be aware, cognizant, and ready for, you know, that Scandinavian, German, I would say even Swedish, Finnish model whereby, well, there will need to be long drawn out painful negotiations within coalitions and parties to form a coalition government that is, you know, I would say that is formed after election. We go into elections, whether it be November, whether it be January or March, we go into election as three or more separate parties or three or more coalitions. We fight it out. Whoever is able to get the largest number of seats will probably has first dibs into forming a or actually exploring to build a coalition in government. But it will be anyone's game, any one of those three coalitions' game, of which Pakatan Harapan is open and ready to face the fight, number one. Number two, we are willing and open and ready to welcome and to dive right in into this new, at least three-corner, three-party system, coalition politics. And it's going to be difficult because it might mean that we'll have to work with those who betrayed us in the past. It might mean we'll have to work with UMNO, who have been our arch nemesis in the many years gone by. But I always take on this notion and this thinking that actually when politics is most unstable, that is when the people get the most out of politicians and politics. So it's going to be volatile, but it's going to be exciting.
Absolutely. I'm excited just hearing you talk about it. So Howard, I think you've covered what it is, what we have to come for Pakatan Harapan, and you sound ready. The party sounds ready, at least from your diagnosis. So I think we are now in a great position to wrap up our episode. And if you have any message that you would like to share to the listeners of the SOCDEM Asia podcast, be they in Malaysia or in the Asian region or internationally even, we want to open the floor to you now for any final message you would like to share for the listeners of this podcast.
A very, very simple message that impossibilities do not exist in politics, especially here in Asia. Look at what happened in Malaysia. A 60-year-long regime was removed within 2 years. Part and parcel of what managed to disrupt and remove that regime went with the previous regime to bring back a new power that is now bringing tatters in the government that they're part of and is bringing the excitement that we're seeing right now. What we're seeing also in the feeling, or what we've seen in Philippines, I don't mean to criticize your new president, but the fact is that there's definitely a lot of history and baggage with his family and definitely with the previous administration, and you know, all that stuff. Many have thought it's impossible in such a democratized structure and system that is the Philippines. Well, it's happened. In Thailand, well, you know, we saw great excitement in 2018 with Move Forward Party with gaining the number of seats that they got in parliament. Fast forward a few years, few Future Forward Party was banned. There's now a new party called the Move Forward Party by the same players that with the same ideology, but with new reinvigorated energy, despite the fact that there's been, you know, power grabs and coup d'etats and military juntas taking over. The impossibilities that previously were seen as impossible no longer exist. Everything is possible. Now, when people tell you change, reforms are impossible because of what's happened in the past, that is even more reason for each and every single one of us to dive right in and really stick in to do whatever it takes and whatever we think is necessary for social democracy, for democracy, for the people, and for our fellow men and women. Because if we do it, if we take action, and I come from the party called the Democratic Action Party, if we take action, those actions will have a meaning, will have an impact, even if it takes 1 month, 1 year, one decade. If you don't take it, you'll never know, number one. Number two, it will never happen. But if you take it, whether it's 1 month, 1 year, or one decade, it's definitely worth it. So take action, change, bring change, act for change, for democracy, for social democracy. There's no better platform than social democracy, and be part of it.
Amazing. Howard, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. This has been so informative and very exciting, if I might say.
Pleasure is entirely mine. Mm-hmm.
So I want to, first of all, congratulate you and congratulate your country on jailing its kleptocrat. We in the Philippines hope to follow, and we'll find out how soon or how long it will take. But like you said, 1 year, 1 week, 1 year, or one decade, we'll get there. So Howard, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the Stop Them Asia podcast.
Thank you.
Okay, wow, that was amazing. That was fun. I really enjoyed that discussion as a Filipino and also as a socialist. It is possible. I mean, that parting shot from Howard, nothing impossible. There's nothing that is impossible in politics. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, my sense is like, you know, things happen with you don't expect, right? Like people make decisions, or what, you know, what happens in politics doesn't always make sense. it's not always what you expect.
Yeah, but I hope that our listeners really enjoyed this episode, and that they really got to feel the, like, this is a very soft word for it, but the insult really of having money that belongs to your country, it belongs to you, and it belongs to your neighbors, and it belongs to the farmers that grow your food, and the people that sweep the streets, and the teachers in the schools, and the nurses, and to have that kind of money stolen and wasted. I hope that our listeners can take away the fact that you don't have to put up with it. The Malaysian people didn't put up with it, and now an unbelievable kleptocrat and a thief is now in jail.
And it's really it's really satisfying for a lot of Malaysians, especially when we went there a couple months back. They were really saying that, you know, it's a satisfying feeling of jailing the former prime minister. And that happened like in a conference during over dinner, and I was kind of confused why they were all celebrating. They started to sing, whatever.
But turns they deserve out
that,
it. They
yeah,
deserve
because
it.
They deserve that victory. So yeah.
Yeah, just for the context of our for our listeners who are not familiar with Filipino slang, sana all means I wish that applies to everyone. Hopefully everyone can experience it. So I hope everyone has enjoyed this episode. I really enjoyed recording it, and I'm so grateful to Howard for giving us time, as in he's so busy right now, given he talked about how they're preparing.
Yeah, the election's upcoming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I hope our listeners really enjoyed this episode. I mean, Carlo and I really enjoyed recording it. If you have comments about this episode or any episode that we've done, really, and even ideas for future episodes that you'd like for us to do. And actually, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and say it. If you have people that you would like to hear on the podcast, please connect us with them. So I'm not saying just recommend a person. If you can loop them into the email, that would be so much appreciated.
Yeah, so don't forget to message us, don't forget to email us, and also don't forget to follow us on Facebook, the SockDem Asia page, and please subscribe to this podcast. We're on Spotify, so that's all.
Absolutely. So until the next time we see you, until the next time you hear us, this has been the SockDem Asia podcast. I am your host, and my name is Cassie.
I'm Carlo.
And we'll see you next time, or you'll hear us next time. Take care.
Bye-bye.